Revelation chapter 14, beginning at verse 1. And I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on the Mount Zion, with him 144,000, having his Father's name written in their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven, as the voice of many waters, as the voice of a great thunder. And I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps. I like that. And they sung, as it were, a new song before the throne and before the four beasts and the elders. And no man could learn that song except the 144,000, which were redeemed from the earth. These are they, verse 4, which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. Over the years, I have noticed something. It's intriguing to me. And that is, when people go through trials and tribulations, and believe me, all people do go through trials and tribulations. When people go through trials and tribulations, one of two things inevitably happens. Either in that tribulation they're going through, their faith will ignite and burn bright. They'll ignite and find themselves on fire like they never were before. Or their faith is quenched and they burn out and their faith grows colder. And in virtually every case that I have observed, I have seen this pattern. Tribulation comes, a trial is there, and either the person burns brighter or burns out. Now we see this same principle in the scriptures. We see three guys who are sort of heroes of mine who were going through tribulation. They would end up in a fiery trial. Their names, Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego. Nebuchadnezzar, as you well know, made a statue and demanded that all the people, when this music was sounded, that everyone fall down and worship the image, the beast, the idol. Three Hebrew children, three Jewish young men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, refused to bow down. Nebuchadnezzar said, if you don't bow down to the image, to the idol, then you're going to be cast in that fiery furnace. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said, so be it. God is able to deliver us. But even if he doesn't deliver us, we will not bow down to that image, to your idol. Well, they were thrown in the fiery furnace. And guess what? Hey, in their fiery trial, in their great tribulation, they didn't burn out. Rather, their faith was shining brightly, was ignited greatly. They were burning red hot, you see. They went through that trial gloriously, unharmed, and left a powerful witness in the eyes of Nebuchadnezzar, indeed in the whole Babylonian Empire. Contrast that, though, with another person in the Bible. He wasn't in the fire, he was by the fire. He too was going through tribulation or trial. He couldn't believe what was happening. I mean, he left everything to follow this rabbi there in Galilee. He left his business, he left his family, he left everything. And now, after 3 years, the one that he was looking to, the one that he was believing in, the one that he was depending on, is being carried off by the soldiers that were sent by the high priest, is being carried off to be crucified. And Peter there that night is by a fire. And again, you know the story. He swore blankety blank, 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 I don't even know him, when he was asked if he was a disciple of Jesus. See, Peter, in his trial, in his disappointment, in his tribulation, ended up burning out. Burning hot, burning out. What will it be? In a tribulation, one of the two will happen inevitably. You will either find your faith, I will either see my faith flaring up and getting hot, or I will find my faith and see my faith burning out and getting cold. Now, I say that to say this. Revelation was written by a pastor. His name, John. John was an interesting man, as we have seen. He was a pastor indeed. He was also a prophet and a poet. And John understands something. The seven churches that John evidently is overseeing, the churches that are listed in Revelation chapters 2 and 3, he knows. He knows that his people, the folks he's linked to, the folks he cares about, that they are going through tribulation. Not unlike what happened to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. For you see, those people that are in John's day, around the year 96 AD, are being forced to confess annually, are being forced to state verbally that Caesar is Lord. And if they did not make that verbal declaration and present a little offering there to the pagan priest, that they would be cut off. They would be economically boycotted. That is, they could not buy or sell unless they bowed down to the beast, Caesar. They couldn't buy or sell. They would be cut off, boycotted economically. That's the best thing that would happen. Because you see, it was not only being ostracized or cut off economically and culturally, but many of these Caesars were not satisfied with that. But they would seek to take the lives of these brothers and sisters of ours who did not bow to the beast, Caesar. They were carried off by the tens of thousands and crucified in contorted positions, torturously. Even as Peter, the apostle, would be crucified upside down. The Roman soldiers got a sadistic kind of pleasure out of crucifying in all sorts of bizarre body positions these Christians who would not say Caesar is Lord. Or they would be dipped in hot wax and later on burned as torches in the gardens of Caesar. Or they would be fed to the lions, as was the case with hundreds of thousands, literally fed to the lions. Now, Pastor John, the one who wrote these words, he himself at this time is on the island of Patmos because he himself is in exile, persecuted, banished. Tradition says they tried to kill him, but he wouldn't die. So they put him out on the island of Patmos. And now Pastor John, the revelator, realizes something. As a pastor, he would know. My people, the folks I care about, the folks I'm linked to, They're going through tribulation. The beast, Caesar, is insisting that they bow down. The beast, Caesar, is demanding that they worship him. And I know what's going to happen. That the people that are in my churches, John may say, some are going to ignite. They're going to get hot. They're going to stay strong. This is going to be their moment. But others, in the same tribulation, will be vulnerable to collapsing, giving up, burning out, throwing in the towel. See, Pastor John knows the stakes are high. It's brilliant what now happens in the book of Revelation. Because, you see, John, the pastor, is also John the prophet, who is given a revelation of what is going to be in the last days. What is going to be in the last days? Well, chapter 13, we saw that there is going to come a beast from out of the sea, out of the Gentile nations. And this beast, we know, is Antichrist, who will demand that people worship him, or they will not be able to buy or sell anything. We studied that in chapter 13. John understands that what is going to happen in the last days, in that period called the tribulation, which, by the way, is talked about in chapters what? 6 through 19. That what is going to happen in the tribulation is happening to a lesser degree, if you would, in their lives at that time. There's a beast demanding to be worshipped. His name is Caesar. Their lives are being threatened. They're being persecuted. And John knows that there's going to be a vulnerability. So what happens? In this prophetic vision that he is given, he's now able in chapter 14, in the text that we just read together, to say, hey, congregants, hey, sisters and brothers here in the year 96 AD, there's coming a group of people that, like you, are going to go through fiery difficulties, even a more intense tribulation. And guess what? Pastor John would say, guess what? The Revelator would declare that day. Guess what? There's 144,000 that make it through the tribulation, who take not the mark of the beast, who don't give in. They make it through. And verse 1, we see them now standing with the Lord. How many? It says 144,000. Who are these 144,000? We saw they are first introduced in chapter 7. 12,000 Jewish men from 12 tribes. 12 times 12 is what? Right. So you have 144,000 in totality who are servants of the Lord in the time of the tribulation, that 7-year period of time described in Revelation chapters what? 6 through 19. Now, these 144,000 are doing what? They're fanning out throughout the globe, sharing truth, because we, the church, Christians, are not going to be around for this period of time called the tribulation. Where are we going to be? And that is described in what chapters? Right, chapters 4 and 5. We'll be in heaven, because chapters 4 and 5 always come before 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 through 19, you see. There's a divine chronology there, a simple chronology. We're in heaven, but God is still attempting to reach people. How does he do it? Well, one of his vehicles is through these 144,000 Jewish evangelists. They fan out throughout the globe, sharing the word. And guess what? They've now gone through a chunk of the tribulation. We read in verse 1, and now standing with the Lord on Mount Zion are 144,000. What's John saying? They made it. They didn't collapse. They didn't give in. They weren't wiped out. It doesn't say standing there with the Lamb were 143,998. Bummer, lost one. But rather it says that each one of those in that tribulation, man, the Lord saw them through, and now they're with Him on Mount Zion. Now, who are these people? Well, we know, mentioned in chapter 7, what they're about, but who are they? Here is the defining phrase that you need to mark and understand. Who are they? Who are they? Okay, John, they're Jewish evangelists, workers, servants, but who really are they? These that don't collapse, these that make it through. Who are they? Verse 4, it defines them uniquely in this way. Verse 4, these are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. Huh? The ones that made it through, the ones that made it to the end successfully, are defined in Revelation 14 as virgins who didn't defile themselves morally. So what are you suggesting, Pastor John, in the year 96 AD? Listen. He's telling you something. He's telling me something of great practicality in 1997. It doesn't just apply to the tribulation that's coming, nor to their tribulation historically, but it applies to your tribulation presently. Because Jesus said, in the world you shall have what? Tribulation. And what's going to happen? When tribulation comes your way, you are going to be, I am going to be vulnerable. To do what? To say, oh man, I was counting on that job and it didn't work out. I thought the marriage was going to be something special and it's brutal. I really believed the door was going to open professionally, and it didn't happen. I thought at this point I would have something in the bank, and my account is overdrawn again. My kids aren't turning out. The doctor says it doesn't look good. Oh, man. Is this what it's about? Christianity? Is this the abundant life that people talk about that Jesus promised so specifically? And at that point, when you hit your tribulation, and you will, when I hit my tribulation, and I will, there will be a temptation to compromise morally. What do you mean? Forget it. I just got to get my mind off this stuff. I'm so sad. I'll just go to Mutz. And so I drive into Mutz and I sit there and down a couple of cold ones and think, well, I'm justified. I mean, the Lord didn't do what I thought He promised to, and it's not working out for me the way that they said it would in Bible study. And you have a couple of cold ones at Mutz, and you finally find yourself driving downtown and you park in front of Les Dolls. And you cruise in there and you think, oh man, I'm just so discouraged. I'm so disappointed. Well, why not? Or maybe you're a little more sophisticated than that. Maybe you'll say, honey, I need to work on my taxes. And you log on to the internet. And you're just so defeated and blue and discouraged are you that you normally wouldn't go there. You normally wouldn't log in. You normally wouldn't do that. But hey, what do you expect? And you find the website calling to you or whatever it might be, and you enter in. There you are. Tribulation. Causing you to compromise morally. Or, man, I've waited forever for some Christian guy to ask me out. What's wrong with those guys at Applegate? What's wrong? I've been waiting and waiting and nothing's happening. And so finally you say, I know this guy has kind of a worldly reputation, but he's real handsome. And, you know, I'm sad, discouraged. God knows that. I'm justified in whatever it might be. It's in the time of tribulation when you bow down to the beast that is demanding. Revelation 13. You bow down before the idol and you say, I'm forgiven. I'm in Christ, and it's okay if I get my mind off this stuff for a while in this way or doing that or going there. And Pastor John, our friend, our brother here, is saying, wait. Think it through. I know Revelation 13, the beast is demanding from you. But think it through. There are virgins who do not defile themselves with women. That is, they're not getting sucked into compromising moral situations. Just like Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego in days of old, who didn't bow down to the image then, just like there will be in the tribulation, in the last days, 144,000 won't bow down and defile themselves with women. So Pastor John, to his congregation, would say, you too can make it through. Now you may say, so what does that have to do with me? This Pastor John, up here on this stool, is telling you and reminding me that so can we. We're living in dark days, folks. The temptations are intense, and the vulnerability is there to let down, to give in. And you may say, why not? John tells us why not. I want you to jot down, if you have a pencil and paper handy, six things that John tells us in our text, in this poetry, in this prophecy, in his pastoring, six things that he tells you, tells me, of why we shouldn't give in. What is the advantage in our tribulation, in our trials, in these dark days to say, I will not defile myself with women. I will be a virgin. That is, I will fight for and I will walk in purity. Why would you want to? First of all, numero uno. That's number one. Number one, verse one. These virgins, they are virgins. They have the Lord on their mind. Notice that. They have the Lord on their mind. It says, the last phrase in verse 1, they have the Father's name written in their foreheads. Here's the thing. You choose to walk in purity, and the Lord will be on your mind constantly. Just like these guys in the vision have the name of the Father in their forehead, so too will you as a virgin, if you would, one who is standing for purity, you too will have the Lord on your mind constantly. Now you say, so what? Who cares? Here's what. Isaiah 26 verse 3 says, and thou shalt keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is what? Stayed on thee. You will have peace of mind if your mind is on the Lord. And your mind will be on the Lord if you choose to walk and to live in purity. That is why Paul, I'll read it to you from Romans chapter 16. He says, I would have you to be wise concerning that which is good, but simple or ignorant concerning that which is evil. I want you to be wise and knowledgeable about that which is good, but you should be simpletons. You should be the guy that doesn't get it when everybody else is telling the joke. You should be the one that goes, huh? You should be the one that when everybody else says, can you believe that he won the Oscar? You should say, who? When it comes to evil, we are to be simple. The word there literally is stupid. We're to be dummies when it comes to sin. The word says, I want you to be wise when it comes to the things of God. But hey, pride yourself in being totally out of touch with stuff that is evil. You should be proud of the fact that you can't quote the lyrics of the latest rap song. Take pride in that, the Bible would say. Be dumb as it relates to the world, you see. Well, why? How come? Because here's the deal. Listen carefully. If I decide late at night to watch cable TV, I'm depressed, I'm discouraged, want to get my mind off it. If I decide to read the trashy novel, that's not that bad. All the ladies are doing it. If I decide to, you know, listen to the MTV videos so that I can know how to pray for the next generation properly. See, whatever it might be that I justify my compromising purity in, I will then come before the Lord and I will say time and again, forgive me, Father. And guess what? Boom, I'm forgiven. It's grand. The moment I make confession, I'm totally, completely forgiven, and the sin which I've done is forgotten. But ask Peter John. He'll tell you the other side of the equation. When he was 3, it was Christmas morning, Christmas Day. And at that time, years ago, before it became popular, I was really into bears. I had tons of bears, lots of bears. And then it became sort of a craze, and I couldn't bear it anymore. But I had bears, lots of bears. Well, on that Christmas day, when Peter was 3, I was given a footstool that had a great hand-painted bear on it. It was a classic. It was great. And I really liked this footstool. Well, later on in the day, we were in the other room, and I heard this pounding sound coming from the front room around the tree. You know, Peter had been given a little tool set that same Christmas. And I go out in the front room. We went out there, and there was Peter John. This is a true story. He's sitting there with his new tool set, hammer in hand, and 6 or 8 nails there in the bear. And I walked in and I saw him, and this is true. He looked up at me with his hammer in his hand and nails sticking out of the bear. He was nailing the bear, quite literally. And he looked at me and he said, Daddy, pray for me. And, you know, inside I'm busting up, you know. He knows he's in trouble. He knows he did wrong. And so I said, okay, Pete. And I prayed for Peter and I led him in a simple prayer. Lord, thank you that you forgive us for our naughty things that we do, that you died for our sins, that nails went through your hands and feet to pay the price for our mistakes. Lord, thank you, thank you. And Peter felt a lot better. And then I said, watch this, Pete. And I pulled those 6 or 8 nails out of the bear, the hand-painted bear on the footstool. And he was delighted with every nail that was being pulled out. But the problem was, as he saw, the holes remained. The nails were gone, but the holes remained. I still have that footstool. It's a classic. It's a reminder. And if I ever need to talk to Peter, I just hold it up. See, here's the thing. Yeah, you can go on the internet. Sure, you can tune in to cable. Okay, go to the movie. Everybody else is doing whatever it is, you see. And then you can say, Father, I did that in a moment of depression. Forgive me. And guess what? You're forgiven right then, and it's forgotten by the Father, but you won't forget it. That's the problem. The hole is left. The nail is pulled out, but the hole is left. This is a great mystery to me about the human psyche. Great mystery. I mean, I would love to talk to Jeff. Jeff Miles, our neighborhood bully, who lived down the street on Cameo, I guess it was. The guy that was the first guy in the neighborhood to smoke cigarettes, the guy that would tie firecrackers to cats' tails and put them down the drain and all that stuff. Jeff was a character. And Jeff came up to me when I was in fourth or fifth grade. I was standing there waiting for something, just standing there. And Jeff came up to me and he told me this 4-line little ditty. It's stupid, it's dumb, it's crude, it's dirty. It's just dumb. I was in fourth grade. I'm now 44, and you know what? I can tell you that ditty. And it bugs me. Now, this is the mystery to me. That sticks with me. But I can go to a Bible study. Maybe you can relate to this. And you're blessed. Maybe you can't relate to that. But you're blessed, and you're challenged, and you're touched, and you leave and you share with somebody you see on Monday, man, I really got blessed and I was challenged and spoken to at service yesterday. Oh, really? Well, what did Pastor talk about? Now, why is that, folks? Do any of you go through that at all? I mean, why is it that we can remember the ditty from fourth grade, but we can't remember the Bible study from yesterday? The mind is an amazing thing. And there is an enemy that is against us called Satan, the adversary. And there is a flesh within us, and the enemy against us and the flesh within us combine to not let those images, those jokes, those ditties, those stories, those things that you take in, that you become open to in the time of tribulation, those things will stay with you all of your days. That's the problem.
What's wrong with that?
A whole lot. Because suddenly you logged on, you looked at, you bought the ticket for, whatever it might be, and you watch some unreal plastic fantasy. And the person that you're married to, he doesn't live up to that, or she doesn't match up to that. And suddenly, without your even being able to explain it, you become increasingly dissatisfied with the person that you're married to. And the seeds are planted for destruction of the family. Because in your tribulation, in my tribulation, I thought, well, I deserve to take a peek, to read the thing, to go there, to let down a bit. After all, God isn't doing what I thought He would. God forgives me. God forgives you. Immediately. The problem is the image stays. The hole is there, and it will haunt you in years to come. So what did David say, a man who knew something about looking where he shouldn't have looked and doing what he shouldn't have done? David, a man after God's own heart, but a man who himself succumbed, defiled himself with women. He concludes, and I'll read it to you, jot it down for your notes. He says in Psalm 101, verse 3, he says, I will set no wicked thing before mine eyes. Listen, folks, that little scripture should be written, I think, in the minds and on the hearts of every believer. I will set no wicked thing before mine eyes. Period. Put it on your TV set. Tape it to your radio dial. I will set no wicked thing before... Period. I don't care if everybody else is watching those movies. I don't care what it's rated and how acceptable it might become in our culture. Well, it's just PG or PG-13 or whatever. If it's wicked, David said, I am not going to put it before my eyes. Period. He's a man that speaks from experience, from heartbreak, from heartache, from tragedy. He learned his lesson. The virgins, the ones that didn't defile themselves, are those that have the Lord on their mind, peace of mind, instead of problems and ghosts and images plaguing them. Number two, they not only have the Lord on their mind, but secondly, if you're jotting down the notes, write, they have authority in their voice. Verse 2, I heard a voice from heaven, as the voice of many waters, as the voice of a great thunder. And I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps. The voice described here of many waters like thunder refers to the 144,000. And they play these harps too. What does that mean? Their voice was like thunder. It was earth-shaking. It was impacting. It was heard. Their voice was like thunder. 3 weeks ago in my study here at the fellowship, sat down with a couple who were understandably upset because their daughter, who was with them, just unbeknownst to them, had an abortion. 14 years of age. And I'll never forget the conversation as it relates to this aspect. They were expressing, understandably, their hurt, their anger, their sadness. And the girl looked over at the mom and she said, what about you? You guys messed around, and you still do. And you could hear a pin drop because the voice of mom and dad were silenced because what she said was true. And here parents who desired to see their daughter make wise and good decisions could say nothing because their lives were filled with compromises and had been previously. There is such a power in the voice of a person, of a parent, of a high school student, of a junior higher. It's like thunder. There is power in the voice of a person who is living in purity. It's like thunder. It's heard. But a person who is not living in purity, their voice to their parents or their co-workers or fellow students falls on deaf ears. There is no authority. Authority and integrity are linked together inextricably. You cannot separate the two. Now, if you think, well, my kids will never know. My grandkids will never hear. if you think the guys at work, they don't have a clue what I do late at night or what I listen to, let me tell you something. You're underestimating the discerning ability of the human spirit. Even if people don't know your story, they can sense in your voice, they can see on your face, they can discern in their hearts whether or not you are a person, I am a person of integrity or not. If you're clever, you can learn to cover, disguise, and couch, but guess what? It's going to be seen through rather easily. These virgins, their voice was like thunder, and they're playing harps. Harpers harping on their harps. What does that mean? When you read the scriptures in the Psalms, you find out that the harps are referred to often as 10-stringed instruments. 10-stringed instruments. Now, what's a 10-stringed instrument mean? Well, these who read the Old Testament, these who know the stories, like you guys, would immediately say, 10 strings? That's the law, 10 commandments. It's what God declared is the way that life should be lived. 10 commandments, 10 strings. In other words, these virgins who were pure were able to play a harp that was in tune, that wasn't missing a string. Ever watch these guys up here who lead worship or sing special songs, the bands? A string or two will break, they scramble. When a string or two breaks on the guitar, I mean, all of a sudden they're, you know, switching guitars around or going backstage to try and find another spare instrument or whatever. In fact, we keep spare guitars backstage. Because, you know, when strings start to break, the music sounds real tinny. It lacks. It's not very pretty. And so too with these harpists, man. You start to say, well, I don't need to live pure after all, man. I'm bummed. I'm blue. My wife treats me like dirt, or my husband doesn't understand what I'm going through, or my parents, you know. And you break the strings. You break the law. And you find out that there's a tinniness. There's a lack. Now, John is after our hearts here. In chapter 4, he's saying, these guys who are virgins, look what they discovered. So will you if you choose in the time of tribulation to not cave in to moral compromise. The Lord will be on your mind. There'll be authority in your voice. Number 3, there'll be a song on your lips. That's what he goes on to tell us in verse 3. And they sang, as it were, a new song before the throne. No man could learn this song but the 144,000 which were redeemed from the earth. They had a song on their lips. This song that only they could sing is a new song. The idea of a new song always implies a song of rejoicing or happiness. Now listen, these guys are happy. They have a new song. Others couldn't sing it. They couldn't. But the 144,000, these that chose to live in purity, they had a song on their lips. A happy song. Listen, this may come as a shock to you if you're new to the things of the Word or the things of the Lord. But God is a happy God. Did you know that? He is happy. When Jesus was walking around, God in the flesh, the reason that people left everything to follow him, the reason that they traveled and listened to what he was saying for 3 days when they hadn't anything to eat during that time. You think you're sitting through long teachings. There is something about him that was so joyful, so happy, so abundant that they wanted to listen and learn and follow. He wasn't dour and sad and heavy and like a man who was soaked in lemon juice. He had a vitality to him. People love to follow him and be with him because there's something that's... How do I know that? Hebrews chapter 1. Listen to what Hebrews 1 says, and it's the key. Speaking about the Son, Jesus, Hebrews 1 says, because thou hast loved righteousness and hated iniquity, thou art anointed with the oil of gladness above thy fellows. In other words, you're the gladdest man in history. The happiest person who ever lived, really. The gladdest person in history, Hebrews 1 says specifically, is the man that, what? Hated sin. Now in that, I'm beginning to understand something. Please don't miss this. Your happiness in life will be directly proportional to your holiness in life. Happy are the people whose God is the Lord. That is, He has authority. I am His. He is God. I am not. He says, live this way. Even if I don't agree in my flesh, He's the Lord, and I choose to, and I will stay away from that and turn my back on the other, even if I think I deserve a break. The holier you choose to be, the holier I decide to be, the happier you will be. Listen. In direct proportion, happiness and holiness travel together. Lots of holiness, lots of happiness. Limited holiness, limited happiness. At this point in my life, I've been able to talk with perhaps thousands. I really think so. In speaking engagements and camps and retreats and church stuff and here at Applegate, I think I've talked to thousands of couples that have troubled marriages. It's interesting to me because a great percentage of these troubled marriages deal with sexual problems. And I have found something to be true. In every single instance, there is a problem sexually because of a compromise that was made morally. Or a compromise that is being made morally. Now, kids, listen to me very carefully here, because you that are single, that are not yet married, listen. I have never, ever, ever, not one time, ever, in 20 years of listening to people's difficulties and challenges, never one time have I heard a man or a woman who is going through troubles in their marriage say, man, I wish I would have messed around more and fornicated and adulterized more. I wish I would have done that. Never. Never. You know what I hear? This thing that we did, that I did, that she did, whatever it was 10 years ago, is haunting us today. And we're not able to enjoy each other, and we're not able to come together in the way that we thought we would be able to, or that we even used to. It's caught up with us. See, God designed sex. It's His idea. It's extremely glorious. It's a mega blessing. It's warming. It's enlightening. It's inviting. It's romantic. It's like a fire in a fireplace. And you have that fireplace in your front room burning brightly, man. And it's romantic and interesting and warming and exciting. But if you choose to say, well, why restrict that fire that's so bright and warm to that fireplace? Let's just move the fire out 3 feet, a little closer to us. What do you say? I say you're going to get burned. The same fire that is so beautiful in the fireplace, you move it out of the firebox, out of the fireplace, just a few feet. Guess what happens? You lose your house. Listen, people, that's the whole deal with sex. In the fireplace, it is warm, romantic, enlightening, inviting. It's grand and glorious, and it's God's idea. And just like fire, he says, in the fireplace it works. Outside of the firebox, you're burned. And no one beats the rap. Nobody. You sit there and you say, hey, man, I am. Right now I've got this thing going. Or right now I've got this subscription coming. Or right now I'm kind of a film critic of sorts. And you think that you're beating the rap. I'm going to tell you something. You're not. The Bible says there is pleasure in sin for a season. And after that, without exception, comes destruction. There just is no exception. I promise you, you're going down. If you choose, if I decide in my tribulation, life is so hard, I just need to escape for a moment. If I decide to do that, and I can't, know this, there will come destruction. And there are no exceptions. On the other hand, if I hate iniquity, if I choose to say I will set no wicked thing before mine eyes, I'm not going to, I don't care if everybody in school is going to that party, that dance, that whatever, I'm not going to. I know what that party is about. I know what that movie's going to do. I know what that gathering is for, and I'm not going to be there. And if I'm the only one at North or at South or at Cascade, if I'm the only one that's not going, so be it. I am going to race towards holiness. I guarantee this. You will experience happiness. Walk away from holiness and you will experience sadness. It's just that simple. These guys, these virgins, they have the Lord on their minds. They have authority in their voice. They have a song on their lips. They have, quickly here, they have the Lamb in their sight. I like this. Verse 4 goes on to say, after identifying them as being virgins, it says, these are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. Wherever the Lamb goes, the virgins are there. The Lamb goes right, they go right. The Lamb goes left, they go left. The Lamb goes straight, they go straight. They follow the Lamb. Now, how often have you heard people say, well, I just don't know which way to go. I don't know what the Lord's will is. Where is the Lord? Is he even here? How come I pray and I don't get any direction? I just don't understand. Where is he? Listen. The sun, that object that comes out occasionally around here, the sun, it's huge in size. How huge? Listen to this. If you take the sun and you hollow the sun out, scoop out all the inside sun stuff, you can fit inside the sun, just leaving its core, you can fit inside the sun 1,300,000 planet Earths. I mean, really think about that. 1,300,000. In other words, our Earth is only 1,300,000th the size of the sun. The sun is gigantic. And man, it is warming and illuminating and it is life-giving. But you know what? I can walk outside today and I can stand there and that great, big, illuminating, glorious, powerful, life-giving sun, I can block it out with my thumb. I can block out the massive, warm-giving, illuminating, life-giving sun. I can block it out with my thumb. Just put it right there. People say, well, you guys say that God is so warm and so big and so guiding and so there. Where is he? I just don't know where he's going. I don't know what he's doing. Which way did he go? And you hear that a lot. And I hear that a bunch. You know what it is? It's your dumb thumb. God doesn't leave you. What did he say? I will never leave you nor forsake you. I don't care if you're good or bad. I don't care what you're up to or not up to. The fact of the matter is, God never leaves me and he never leaves you. But the problem is our thumb. Sin. I can no longer figure out where he is or what he's up to, or I feel confused. Move the dumb thumb. See? When I move the thumb, I see the sun. That's what sin does. That's why the virgins, they follow the Lamb. Going right, got it. Going left, great. Going up, great. Going down, no problem. They're just following right along because they're virgins. Purity. Holiness. Not compromising. And they see the Son, they see the Lamb clearly, and they follow him easily. Number five. They not only have the Lord on their minds and authority in their voices and a song on their lips and the Lamb in their sight, but number five, they have fruit for their God. The last phrase in verse 4. These virgins were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb. First fruits means, hey, the best stuff. God says, these virgins are first fruits to me. The cream of the crop, if you would. Listen. You might not care about being happy. You might not care about being blessed in your marriage sexually. You might not care about having direction for your life personally. You might not care about speaking with authority. But perhaps, for some reason, you really do care about what God thinks of you. God says these virgins are the first fruits. Of all the people in this tribulation, all the people going through this trial, Revelation 6 through 19, these are the first fruits to me. These are the finest, if you would. These are people that have chosen to not defile themselves. They've made a tough choice. And God says, delightful, tasty, first fruit for me, you see. Perhaps you're 15. Maybe you say, I'm 17, or I'm 19, or I'm 20. Well, not me. I mean, I'm 24. But maybe you're here today and you say, John, I don't get this whole thing. I mean, I'm 15 years old, or I'm 16 years old, or I'm 18 years old. I don't understand this. I have passion and desire, and there's stuff all around me, and I don't understand. God here is telling me to be pure and to be a virgin and to walk in holiness, and there's all this stuff, this beast that's raising up in me, this fire that's burning within me. I don't understand. It seems cruel, John. If God designed sex like you say, then why couldn't he have just put a switch right here on my belly that would just be in the off position until the day I get married, and then you click it on, see, and then things kick in and all that takes. Why couldn't he have done it that way? I mean, why? Did you ever catch the irony that sometimes the strongest passions a person feels are when they're in those years when, man, I feel this passion, this desire, and mom says I can't get married. She says, I've got to finish junior high first. I don't understand that. So what am I to do, John? I mean, I've got this stuff. I've got this passion. Listen, don't you understand? Can't you see? God didn't goof when he made you the way that he made you. We go to Camp Bradley, us high schoolers, or you high schoolers, and I'll be there, and we stand, man, we stand at the Cascade graduation. We stand on the retreats up the mountaintop, and we sing as Rick or Jim Wright or Zach leads us in songs. We sing, I'm going to stand, I'm going to stand. Even if I have to stand alone, I'm going to carry the torch in this dark world. And we sing, I have decided to follow Jesus. Though none go with me, still I will follow. And tears flow down our cheeks and we say, I'm going to stand if I have to stand alone, and I'm going to follow the cross before me, the world behind me, kumbaya. And we sing the songs and tears roll down our cheeks. And the Lord says, really? He says, I love it. You want to stand, even if you have to stand alone. You want to say, the world behind me, the cross before me, I'm going to give you a unique opportunity. You're going to say no to the beast within you for me. And you know what I'm going to do? It's going to be something which you are choosing to sacrifice painfully sometimes. And it's fruit for me. First fruits. Delightful. And then you see, you just can't outgive me. You watch what I'll do for you in the years to come. You watch how I'll bless you. You watch how I'll use you and bless you. You watch and see what I'll do, because you just really can't outgive me, God says. You give him the first fruits and watch and see the crop that he hurls down in your direction. What an opportunity if you're single here to say, I'm going to go against the flow, like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Burn if I have to, but I'm not going to bow. It's going to be more than campfire songs from my lips. It's going to be a true commitment that I make that can be difficult and painful. Maybe you're in an unhappy marriage or a difficult marriage. You too have the same opportunity to say, wow, I get to choose to take up the cross. And you watch and see how God is going to reward you eternally. You'll never regret purity, ever. One more thing and we're done. The sixth and final thing that Pastor John points out in our text here that these virgins experience is they not only have the Lord on their minds, an authority in their voice, a song on their lips, the Lamb in their sight, they have fruit for their God. But number six, they have sweetness in their mouth. Verse 5, chapter 14, in their mouth was found no guile. No poison is the idea there, no bitterness. Did you know this, folks? If you don't, you need to. The Bible directly links morality, virginity, purity, and holiness with how you talk. I'll read to you. You can just jot it down. But from Ephesians chapter 5, Paul makes an interesting point. He says, but verse 3, fornication and all uncleanness, fornication is sexual immorality, uncleanness, things like pornography, or covetousness, which means wanting what you can't have. Fornication, uncleanness, covetousness, let it not once be named among you as becomes saints. Then in verse 4, neither filthiness, foolish talking, jesting, which are not convenient. The construction of the sentence there is really insightful or interesting. The word neither there is, well, to put it in simplest terms, it's like a train. The first list of things are like the engine. Moral matters, fornication, coveting, uncleanness. Then these next items are like the cars that follow the engine, your coal car, your box car, your caboose. And what Paul is saying is, if we give in to matters that are impure, there's a whole train that follows behind. See, a whole change happens. You get all these box cars, baggage that comes with it. You get filthy talking, foolish talking, jesting, and all sorts of things. And eventually you find yourself speaking and talking in ways that people just don't want to be around you. Now, when a person talks that way, when a person is always telling filthy jokes and foolish jesting and all that kind of stuff, it means that he or she is involved in immorality to some degree. Because that's what's driving it. The stuff, the verbiage, is just the cars that follow the engine, which is compromising in morals. If you want to be one, if I desire to be a person who doesn't speak with sickness and bitterness and guile, then I need to say, Lord, I'm choosing purity today. Now, that's what John tells you, and that's what John says to me. It pays to be pure. Good stuff happens. And he says to those who he's writing to back then, I know you're going through tough times, but listen. Others are coming after you that will make it through. How do they make it through? And how can you in 1997? How can you make it through in the tribulation that you're going through in these dark days in which we're living? He says this. Last phrase, we're done, verse 5. For they are without fault before the throne of God. They're without fault. What do you mean? Jude picks up the same thing when in Jude he declares in verse 24, that classic text, now unto him who is able to keep you from what? Falling. Now unto him who is able to keep you from falling and to present you faultless before the presence of his glory with great joy. Listen, same phrase, same idea, same understanding. You who have failed, and guess what? That is everyone who's in here. We all have failed, folks. But we now are faultless where? Before the throne. Why? Because of the blood of Christ. What? Yes, the blood of Jesus cleanses me from all my failings. And the blood of Jesus cleanses you from all your failings. We are clean. We are faultless before the throne. And now he says, not only are you faultless before the throne, but I will keep you from falling on the earth. You're faultless positionally, but I can keep you now, John. Now that you understand, yes, you're faultless positionally. You always will be because my blood cleanses you, because you've received the gift of salvation. But I can keep you from falling practically if you'll allow me. So today, what do? I come before the throne once again. I say, Father, thank you for forgiving me of my failings and sin. I've fallen short. But Father, I now also understand that there is wisdom in walking in the way you've called me to walk, and that is to be holy. And Lord, I realize that I cannot decide to do it on my own. You are the one that's able to keep me from falling. And you're the one that does present me faultless before the throne. It's a decision that you make. Folks, probably a few of you, some of you, are not going to come back to Applegate again for this simple reason. I don't blame you. You're saying, that guy talks so long, and we have sat so long. I know that I may never talk to some of you again in this format. I understand that. I have chosen to do this because I really, really, really want you to understand one thing. If you never come back here again, I understand. Be holy. Tim, be holy. Choose holiness. Amanda, choose holiness. Decide to be holy. I don't care what everybody else is doing. You will not regret it, Amanda. I guarantee. Peter, be holy. You'll speak with authority. You'll be pleasing to God. You'll understand His will for your life. Be holy. Dan, go for holiness radically. This is the time. This is the day. This is the season, these last days in which we're living, when we need men like you who will say, I'm choosing holiness. Others may think I'm square. Others may think I'm out of it. I'm choosing holiness. And you will be anointed with the oil of gladness above other fellows. It's true. Be holy, Marilyn. Be holy. Decide to let Him do what He wants to, which is to keep you from falling. You're already blameless before the throne. But let Him keep you from falling. Choose virginity, folks. Say no to the music of the world that wants to get you to bow to the idol of Nebuchadnezzar. Say no to the beast that says, I'll get you if you don't let me mark you. Aaron, be holy. Jamie, be holy. Worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness. It's a beautiful thing what holiness will do. Be holy. Be holy. When you fail, you're forgiven. But make no more excuses, no more justification. Be holy. And you will be happy and eternally blessed. I know I've gone way over my allotted time. I'm really desiring for you and me to be holy. My prayer is that the Lord tarries, that in 20 years from now, when we get together and our grandkids are here, some of us, that Applegate Fellowship would be known as the congregation where people are holy. Oh, I don't mean spiritually stuck up and prudish and judgmental and religious. Please don't get religious on me. But be holy. Be holy. Be holy. There are people here that have been just bogged down in sin. You don't understand that you are forgiven, that the Lord will give you a new life if you allow Him. You need to go to the prayer room. You need to go there and say, you know, I've been in the world. I've been doing that stuff, and it's not working, and it's true. And if I could be born again and get a fresh start, I'd love to. Well, guess what? You can't. If you come to the Lord, admit your need, that you're a sinner, and open up your heart, He'll be your Savior. That can happen. Just takes minutes, moments. Go to the prayer room. Talk to one of the pastors or elders. Let them lead you in a prayer to receive Jesus, to embrace salvation. If you're here today and you're a Christian, but you've been kind of just bogged down in stuff, in sin, maybe it would be wise to go to the prayer room. Confess your fault one to another. Pray. And just say, you know what? Man. That's the last thing I wanted to hear, but it's true. I've been traveling where I shouldn't be traveling. And I would like to be free today. Guess what? God forgives. He'll pick you up. He can do amazing things, just like He did with David in the Old Testament, who learned his lesson and went on, still being a man after God's own heart. So can you. Go to prayer about that. And as you go your way today, my prayer is, my desire is that you will be what? Holy. Because holiness leads to happiness and it blesses the Father. And may it be, may it truly be in your lives, in our lives, for His glory. Amen.